And this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. Today I'm going to be talking with two authors who are going to be appearing in this area in the next couple of weeks and who've written very specific takes on 20th century California history. The first is Kevin Nelson, who's written Wheels of Change, From Zero to 600 Miles Per Hour, The Amazing Story of California and the Automobile. And then later in the program, I'll be talking with Gage McKinney about his book, The 1930s, No Depression Here, about how Nevada County went through the doldrums during the 20s when the rest of the country was prosperous and began to prosper when the rest of the country hit the Great Depression. Kevin Nelson is going to be speaking at The Bookseller this Wednesday afternoon at 4 p.m., and he'll be also be at the California Historical Society in San Francisco at 6 p.m. on Wednesday, the 4th of November. I talked to him about his book, Wheels of Change, last week, and this is what we had to say. The first automobiles as we know them, internal combustion engines, were produced in Germany in the 1880s and 90s. The big names were Daimler and Benz, but I guess they reached California before the turn of the century.
That's correct, yeah. Daimler and Benz, they're credited with, they're two German engineers, obviously brilliant, and they later formed Mercedes-Benz, most famously. But for a while, they were independent. Daimler and Benz made their own cars in Germany, and so there were imports, if you want to call them that, that would came to America and California in the 1890s. But there was also an active domestic car building trade, and we in California started to build cars in the late 1890s, basically backyard mechanics, we'd call them today, people who just wanted to explore this new technology and build cars.
And you mentioned a young man named Carl Breer, who made his own when he was still a teenager.
Yeah, Carl Breer was experimenting with steam technology. He built a steam car. And that's one thing that people should remember about today. I mean, we're so fascinated with alternatives to the internal combustion gas engine. And, of course, that's important, such as electric. But people were experimenting with different ways to power automobiles from the very beginning. In the early years, the 1890s and the early 1900s, there were three major technology. One was gasoline car. The other was steam, which is what Carl Breer built in the streets of Los Angeles. And he later became a very important and prestigious Chrysler engineer. And then the final one was electric. People were surprised. Many people were surprised to learn that electrics have been around since the very beginning of cars. The fastest car in the world in 1897 was an electric-powered French make. And what happened, the problem with electrics back then was the problem with electrics now that they're still trying to work out, is the battery. The charge wouldn't last very long, and so electric cars stayed, they were basically known as town cars, because you couldn't take them out in the country, and that's a little bit of the problem today with electrics. Of course, we've got hybrid technology, which solves that problem to some degree. But electrics, the battery charge still doesn't last long enough to satisfy people. But anyway, that's the interesting thing, is so many things having to do with automobiles in the early days and all throughout its history are true today as well.
And gasoline at that time was quite cheap. It was really a not particularly desirable byproduct of kerosene. So it was, if you did have a gasoline engine, it was pretty easy to get the fuel for it.
Well, it was cheap, but it wasn't actually easy because you had to go. There were no gas stations, of course. So you had to buy gasoline in tins. As you say, it was a byproduct of kerosene. It was considered to be a waste product and not very valuable to people. And it was cheap in that sense, but it's still hard to find. And kerosene was mainly used for lighting.
And at that time, there were also, except in the major cities, very few paved roads.
Right, outside of me, I mean, it was a disaster to drive an automobile. It was a real adventure to take cars outside the city. I mean, they were rocky, rough, terrible roads, and were for the first 20, 30 years of people driving cars. The highways we take for granted today, which I know are pretty bumpy with all the budget cuts and so forth, and you do hit holes and all that kind of thing. It was nothing compared to what it was to drive back in those days, back in the early 1900s. It took a long time to develop roads, and actually, what's interesting too, that we associate roads today and the maintenance of roads with government. But in the early days, the roads were created often by private companies and developed in that way. And same with bridges. They were built often by private companies and then later taken over as for maintenance by government.
Yet even at the very beginning, people were adventurous enough to, say, try to drive to Yosemite.
Right, yeah, driving to Yosemite. That's another one of the things, as I was talking about earlier, that some things haven't changed, and people have been arguing about the role of automobiles in Yosemite since the beginning of automobiles, because once cars started coming to Yosemite, more cars started coming, and it started to create traffic problems, and people got upset about cars being in Yosemite. And so for a while, in 1906, they were banned. They were kicked out of the park, but in another half dozen years or so, they were returned to the park. They were able to come into it just because cars were so popular, and people wanted to see Yosemite, and that's what they were driving. This is another thing that's interesting about cars, and it's sort of a double-edged sword when it comes to nature. Well, people might say, well, cars out in nature despoil nature. But in fact, cars bring people out to nature, and cars were one of the ways that people discovered nature. They couldn't get to it before. It was much harder than a horse and buggy. And so cars brought people out to the desert and the mountains and the coast and so much quicker than they were able to before.
You mentioned the double-edged sword, and I noticed that it was not very long after cars appeared in California that the state began licensing them.
That's right, yeah, 1907, I think it was, John Spreckles, who was a fabulously wealthy industrialist and tycoon, got the first license or registration for the state of California. It cost $2, and from there, things have increased. They added taxes, a state gasoline tax in the 1920s, followed by a federal gasoline tax, so the machinery of government has grown along with the use of automobiles.
Now, John Spreckles was a San Francisco tycoon, and you do have a chapter on San Francisco early in the book, which really covers most of Northern California, but most of the book concentrates on Southern California, and that is the place where we associate. If you think of California cars, you think of the LA region. How did that happen?
Well, it's a really interesting question, and that's absolutely true. The story does concentrate on Southern California because its car culture is really pretty unique and still is, although there's a lot in the book about San Francisco and Northern California, especially in the early days. There's a lot of questions why, or a lot of opinions why Southern Californians especially are so oriented toward cars. One, the weather, the nice weather. I mean, it's, for instance, San Francisco or Grass Valley or Nevada City gets rain and there's cold, whereas Southern California, not as much. And then they were settled often by different people. If you go back to the Gold Rush and later, a lot of the people who came to Northern California were from the East Coast, whereas in Southern California, they were from the Midwest. And they were more farmers, and they were used to vehicles and so forth. But this is all ancient history. I mean, Southern California remains a trend center, as does California as a whole, for automobiles. If something happens in the world of automobiles, it almost always happens first in California, and usually in Southern California. And I could just tick off a list of trends that have been started in California. Oh, geez, custom cars, low riding, imported sports cars, drive-ins, drive-in movie theaters, self-serve gas stations, open-air outdoor malls oriented toward the automobile. And it just goes on and on and on. And obviously the movies as well has been a big part of the California driving scene.
You talk about Barney Oldfield, the champion race driver who kept holding the record as the world's fastest driver for quite a few years, how he came to California and eventually settled there, and then he wound up in the movies.
Yeah, he was a fascinating and fabulous character, really. Just, I mean, the book is the story of California and automobiles is populated by these fascinating, intriguing characters, and one is Barney Oldfield, who was the first man to drive 60 miles per hour around a racetrack. And the racetrack he was driving around was an old converted horse track. I mean, it was a dirt track. It was built for horses, not for automobiles. And this is part of the dangers he faced. He used to chew a cigar while he smoked, while he drove, because the clattering of his teeth. I mean, these cars didn't have great suspension systems. They were pretty awful. They were very dangerous. And Barney set a slew of speed records up through the up through World War One and beyond. And was a great character, part of the early lore of racing. And for a guy who cheated death so many times, he had an interesting ending. He just died peacefully in his bed as an old man, and so it was a very sweet irony for him.
But he appeared in movies as well as on...
Oh, yeah, that's right. I apologize. Yes, he was probably in the first automobile chase scene. He shot it with Max Sennett of the Keystone Cops fame. I don't know if anyone wouldn't remember the Keystone Cops, but they're one of the great comedic inventions. And anyway, Max Sennett was the man who whose idea was the Keystone Cops, and he was just a terrific filmmaker, loved cars, knew Barney Oldfield as a great racer, racing in Santa Monica and all these places around California, and so they set up a movie called Barney Oldfield Races for a Life, 1913, I think it was. It was Barney racing his bullet race car against a train to save a woman who happened to be the actress Mabel Normand, tied to the railroad tracks, this classic silent movie scene. And Barney does it, races the train, and they save the girl. And it was probably, I mean, we make a light of it now, but it was probably the most exciting car chase sequence ever put on film at that time. And of course, since then, we've had a few more chasing sequences. One of the ones I talk about in the book is with Steve McQueen, who was an authentic race car driver, a real, true car guy, loved cars, collected cars, and he also raced cars in movies. And most people would remember Bullet, the fantastic chase scene, in my opinion, the greatest chase scene, automobile chase scene ever in the movies, that great chase scene where he's racing down the hills of San Francisco. And also another movie that's worth checking out, Steve McQueen jumping over the barbed wire fences of a prisoner of war camp in World War II in another fine movie, The Great Escape. I definitely recommend those two movies. Unfortunately, you can't see early Barney Oldfield or Keystone Cops movies anymore. Over the years, we've lost track of them.
The other thing we associate Southern California with, of course, with cars, is freeways. How did they come about?
Freeways came about basically after World War II. people, there were so many cars on the road that they had to figure out a way to move these cars around. The first ever freeway in the state and the nation was connected Pasadena with Los Angeles, and there were just so many cars that they had to figure out a way to do it. And there was actually an environmental debate at the time, too. We associate environmentalism, of course, with now and emerging in the 1960s. But even when they were building this freeway, the first freeway, there was concern about the environment and so forth, and also what would happen in terms of pollution. And the general consensus then was that if you had these cars moving more efficiently on a freeway, then there would be less stops and starts, and there would be less gasoline use and less pollution. And there continues to be, even to this day, a disagreement about whether or not that's an effective technique in terms of combating pollution. But yeah, there were freeways and also traffic jams. People associate the traffic jams today, but as soon as the traffic jams actually date back to the ancient Roman Empire, if you can believe it, well before cars, in the time of chariots and horses. And ancient Rome banned chariots in the center of town because they were causing so much congestion. And even if you go back and look at the horse and trolley world of pre-automobiles in someplace like downtown Los Angeles, with bicycles and walkers and trolleys and horses and teams of horses, I mean, it was pretty congested in the downtown, in a downtown city. And then, of course, automobiles come into the picture and create even more congestion. And really, since about the 1920s, cities around California and the United States have tried to figure out ways to sort of limit the impact of automobiles on cities. Not very successfully, obviously. Even Los Angeles in the 1920s experimented or thought about banning cars in the city center, if you can imagine, and it never went through. It just partly because cars bring economic vitality to a place. And that's how people get around. If you want people to shop at your store or traffic at your business, then they're going to come in a car. And so if you start banning the car, then you're going to have a hard time generating business. And so it's that kind of a controversy which exists today, again, also existed in the early days of cars.
Now, your book sort of climaxes in the 1960s. Why did you choose to go that far and not farther?
Well, it was an interesting sort of, the book begins in the 1890s, when there were no cars, and ends, as you say, in the 1960s, when there were millions of cars on the road. In the 1890s, you could walk faster than an automobile could drive. And then by the mid-1960s, you had guys, including most prominently a Californian named Craig Breedlove, who was able to race in an automobile powered by a jet engine 400, 500, and 600 miles per hour. And I thought it was a pretty amazing bookend to go from, as I say in the subtitle, 0 to 600 miles per hour, with all these incredible social changes in between, all these technological changes related to the automobile that in turn caused changes throughout society. And so that was the thinking on that.
And it also seems that however much you may treat cars as a double-edged sword, most people had very positive feelings toward them until about the 60s, and it's about that time that our attitudes have begun to sour a bit.
Well, I would say yes, and I would also say there's really never been a time of innocence for the automobile, because from the beginning, some people who loved horses hated cars because they were smelly and they made noise and they scared horses. And there was always, as I mentioned, the 1920s when they came in with the closed body cars before cars were were open to the air and open to the wind and sun. And then they created closed body cars. And so as soon as people got into these closed body cars, they said, you know, men and women started to do what men and women do. And so there was scandal involved with cars. I mean, there's always been, like you say, a double-edged sword. And it really, as much as there are people who don't like cars today or don't like the impact they have on the environment or the air or whatever, there is a far, far greater majority of people who absolutely love cars. This is what I found in doing the book, and I spent about 3 years on it, driving around the state, talking to people. I mean, car people just absolutely love cars. I mean, they have a real passion. I'd include myself in that number. I mean, I love the freedom and adventure that cars give you. And even people who wouldn't describe themselves as a car person really like the look of cars, the design. They're fantastically beautiful objects. I mean, many of them are art objects on wheels. Just fantastic. They like the way they feel inside, and they like what cars do for people. I mean, what cars say about them to other people. And so even though, yes, and often environmentalists, even the most ardent anti-car people, still drive cars. So, but what I found was basically people still love cars. And because cars represent freedom. I mean, it's the first chance. I mean, kids learn about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution in school, at least I hope they do, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, the first way that kids really find out what freedom is behind the wheel of an automobile. And many Americans, the way they pursue pleasure, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the way they pursued happiness is behind the wheel of a car, and sometimes in the back seat of a car too. So that's one thing I brought out a lot in the book, is that there's sort of almost an orthodoxy about what we should think about cars, but cars have been amazingly important and useful and beneficial devices. They've created freedom, they've created economic opportunity, as well as some of these negative things that a lot of people do refer to.
That was Kevin Nelson, author of Wheels of Change, From 0 to 600 Miles Per Hour, The Amazing Story of California and the Automobile, just out from Heyday Books. He's going to be speaking at the Bookseller in Grass Valley this coming Wednesday, the 28th at 4 p.m. He's also going to be in San Francisco at the California Historical Society the following Wednesday, the 4th of November, at 6 p.m. His publicist has offered a copy of his book to one of our listeners, but since I'm not actually here to take your calls, they've suggested instead that they will give a copy to the first person who emails news@heydaybooks.com. Heyday is spelled H-E-Y-D-A-Y, and then books, all one word, .com, and put Wheels of Change in the subject line. If you're the first person to get an email to them, they'll get a book to you. Gage McKinney has written several books about Nevada County history, most notably When Miners Sang, which is the history of the Grass Valley Cornish Carol Choir. His recent book is called The 1930s, No Depression Here. Both of them were published by Comstock Bonanza Press. He's going to be speaking at an event sponsored by the Friends of the Library at 7 p.m. on Friday, the 6th of November, at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City. He's also going to be speaking about the Cornish Choir at the Grass Valley Newcomers Club at 12:45 p.m. on Wednesday, the 2nd of December, at the Alta Sierra Country Club. I also talked with him last week. I think I can say that this is a book that I've been waiting for almost 40 years. When I first moved to Nevada County, I lived out Ubet Road, close to the remains of the town of Ubet. And people quickly pointed out that the foundations there mostly dated not from the gold rush, but from the 1930s, and that there had been a school there and a church and stores and bars and all the things a small community would have. Ever since then, I wanted somebody to record that time. I also got interested in some of the labor activity in the late 30s when there was an active CIO union in the mines, or trying to be in the mines. It was chased out of town by vigilantes. And you've brought together those two topics and many more, and I can't tell you how glad I am to be reading your book.
Well, thank you very much. Yes, those are two really fascinating aspects of the history in Grass Valley, Nevada City, the northern mines region, during the 1930s. And part of what made that region, our region of the country, have such a different experience of the 30s than any place else.
Now, in your book, you don't start in the 30s. You actually go back to World War I and do a very good job of laying the background. Do you want to run through that quickly? Because most of the country was flourishing in the 20s, Nevada County wasn't, and then in the 30s it reversed.
That's right. The book really covers the interwar years between World War I and World War II, and it's really not possible to understand how people looked at things and how the community was organized without having that background of World War I, because so much of what became government policy and so much of what shaped people's attitudes during the 30s was based upon their experience of the First World War. And then the 1920s, as you point out, when we think of much of the country in this period of growth and prosperity, some of it, of course, not well-founded, Nevada County and the gold mining regions of California in general were in a backward way. All the investment money during that period went into either into the stock market or into what was called the new economies, the new industries like radio and appliances and telephones that were using so much copper. And so mining investment money went into copper, and gold mining was left behind.
And what changed that in the 30s?
Well, what changed that was, of course, that new economy proving not to be of substance, or at least not yet. And and the investment money that survived the stock market crash and that was still available, people, investors, wanted to invest in something sure. They wanted to invest in hard money, and so that meant they wanted to invest in gold. And so much of the investment capital that was available after the crash came to places like Nevada County, where there were possibilities of gold mining. A person who illustrates this well in his life was Errol McBoyle, the man who resuscitated the Idaho Maryland mine. It was a very long term project for him. He worked at that for about 20 years before he really got the mine in a profitable state. During that whole period, he was trying to raise money and found it just about impossible. He never had any money until he was able to strike the paying lead, the Eureka Idaho Maryland lead in the mine, and then he was able to generate his own capital out of the mine proceeds. But that was the late 20s before he was able to do that.
And you point out that there were really two influxes in the Depression years, there was the influx of capital into the large-scale underground mines, and there were also a huge number of essentially gold panners who hit all the rivers that to try to see if there was anything left from 70 years before.
The days of 49 came back again in beginning in 1930, beginning in the spring and summer of 1930, and continuing throughout the decade, especially in the early 30s. You can imagine the branches of the Yuba River and virtually every stream in the region was lined with people who had come from usually from metropolitan areas, had lost their jobs, and had the idea that they could eke out some sort of living through gold panning. And the state of California, through its mining bureau, and other states did this as well, actually encouraged this and gave classes in unlikely places like the Ferry Building in San Francisco to teach people how to go out and prospect along the streams. And hundreds of people did it, especially in the spring and summer and fall. Some of them stayed too long in winter and got trapped in places like Steep Hollow out beyond Ubet and had to be rescued by sleds brought out by the county sheriff and by the Salvation Army.
Did though? The panners or the river prospectors, the placer miners, did they persist through the whole decade?
They did. Their really prominent time was probably the worst years of the Depression, which was 1930 through 32 and into 33. That's when the most of them were there, but many people continued to pursue that kind of work throughout the 30s. The ones who stayed into the later 30s were normally the ones who were most successful. I talk about a couple named Coffey who worked the Yuba River very successfully, a man and wife team, and not only made a living in a modest cabin and hunting for some of their food, but had an idyllic life as they look back at it later. I think you mentioned to me when we talked, Eric, about a family who had found some large amount of gold and came into Grass Valley in ragged clothes and cashed in their gold, bought two new Ford automobiles and drove away. But these people were the exceptions. Most people doing that didn't even make what we would think of as living wages. If they made a dollar a day doing that, they were doing reasonably well.
Whereas the miners who had jobs in the mines, they benefited at first because of the deflation that followed the crash, because their wages were suddenly worth more than they had been before.
That's right. That's right. And then when the price of gold was raised up above $30 an ounce in 1933 and then eventually up to $35 an ounce in 1934, the mines also increased wages. So that the miners had some share in that increase, and so in the early 30s they did well, and miners were able to buy houses and appliances and automobiles and have a kind of life that so many people across the country, where throughout the decade you never had unemployment fall below 14%, and sometimes it was above 25%. So many people across the country could only envy what the miners had in Grass Valley, Nevada City.
Now, this all played out locally, but you point out that the international investment had a lot to do with it, and government policies from Washington had a lot to do with it. And I guess in particular, the activities of our congressman, Harry Engelbreit, had a lot to do with it.
Government policies had a lot to do with it, and that's part of going back to World War One, and what followed from that, people had the expectation that the government would make the economy work. And what happened with government policy and gold initially was very detrimental to gold mining, in that government required everyone, by an executive order signed by Franklin Roosevelt, to turn in their gold at the price of $20.67 an ounce, which had been the price as long as anyone could recall. Harry Engelbreit, who was the congressman who represented the 2nd Congressional District, one of the largest in the country, it ran roughly from Yosemite to the Oregon border, all along the mountain ridges and down into the valley. He immediately went to the Treasury Department and said, this is a disaster for gold mining because there is now an international market developing at over $30 an ounce. And this was a result of the U.S. and other countries, especially Britain, going off of the gold standard. And Engelbreit argued, if American gold miners don't have access to that market, then all the investment money for gold mining will go overseas. It'll go to South Africa and Rhodesia and Canada and other places that do have access to that international market. He made this argument for months in Washington, had face-to-face discussions with President Roosevelt. The president tried to bluff him, told him that asparagus in California was worth more than gold. But Congressman Engelbreit wouldn't give up. He stayed after Congress went home, stayed through the summer in Washington, finally persuaded the Treasury Department to allow U.S. gold producers to sell their gold unrefined on the international market. And that eventually led President Roosevelt, who had his own interest in seeing a rise in commodity prices, to begin a program of the government buying gold at more than $30 an ounce. And this eventually, that price got fixed in 1934 at $35 an ounce, slightly above the international market. So government policy played a big part, ultimately, in making our gold region in California a very rich region during the 1930s.
Now, what sort of mines were operating then? Were they mostly the old ones? You mentioned the Idaho, Maryland that McBoyle resuscitated. There was also the North Star and the Empire, which by this time had been consolidated, and many, many smaller ones, some of them pretty close to downtown in both Grass Valley and Nevada City. Which of these were most successful?
I'm very proud in the book of some of the tables that are in there, and one is a table of the working mines and of their payrolls, and I think people will be surprised to realize that in Grass Valley, Nevada City mining districts, there were over 40 operating mines. Most of them were hard rock mines. There were a few placer or hydraulic mines operating. You mentioned that at Jubette, where there were some hydraulic mines operating. the biggest minds, as you mentioned, the combined North Star and Empire, which became Empire Star, was the biggest employer, owned by Newmont Mining Company. It was their first venture into practical mining. They had just been an investment company before they bought the Empire Mine in 1929. The Idaho, Maryland was a large employer. The Murchie Mine in outside of Nevada City was the third largest mining employer. It was also operated by Newmont. Right downtown Grass Valley, right where the Golden Center Freeway passes over Auburn Street, in that area was the Golden Center Mine that operated under the streets of Grass Valley, and also included a mine up on Alta Hill. And there were a number of other mines throughout the county.
Now, you mentioned that the mine owners actually raised wages as they became more profitable. And in general, labor relations had been pretty good in Nevada County. But toward the end of the decade, there were organizing attempts, and this led to some pretty bitter conflicts.
It did. The union, so-called union, that had existed through the 20s and into the 30s was actually a mutual society called the Mine Workers Protective League. And in 1937, a small group of men met at a house on Ridge Road, just outside of Nevada City, and talked about bringing genuine industrial unionism to the area. And they eventually appealed to a union called the Mine Mill and Smelter Workers, commonly called Mine Mill. And Mine Mill was an affiliate of the CIO, which had broken away from the AFL, was led by John L. Lewis, and was really the spearhead of large-scale industrial unionism in the United States. In 1937, there were 700 strikes across the country, and union membership was surging. The CIO actually had more members by 1938 than the AFL that it had broken away from had. And so the union activity was in Grass Valley, and Nevada City was part of that surge in the late 1930s.
And it was not welcomed.
I think one of the stories that the book brings out is about just the raw courage of these men who brought the CIO and represented the CIO in the area in 1937 and 1938, because they did face a very hostile community. People of the area generally had a sense of their very good fortune to be there, to have the wages that they had, to have the jobs that they had. And the introduction of industrial scale unionism really wasn't welcomed by most people. The CIO men persisted, and they got painted with the broad brush of being outsiders who had come in to do this. And, of course, the union organizers themselves, the men who were actually employed by the union, did come from outside. They came largely from the silver and copper mining regions of the Rocky Mountains. But there were a number of local men who were behind this effort, and most obvious were the Garicio brothers, Joe and Al, who grew up in Indian Springs, just outside of Nevada City, where their father farmed and ranched on a homestead. There was also a very interesting Cornish miner named Gilbert, and the Cornish were normally thought of to be anti-CIO, but Irving Gilbert had grown up in Nevada City. He'd worked for the railroad for a time, and that's apparently when he became interested in socialism. And at one point, he lived on a socialist commune in Antelope Valley in the 1920s. And when he came back to his hometown for a mining job, he was one of the local men who got behind the CIO movement.
But eventually, essentially, vigilantes chased them away.
That's right. The CIO had some initial success with contracts at the Lavacap and Banner mines near Nevada City. But it was when they tried to unionize the Merchie, and they were targeting the Newmont Mining Company. When they tried to unionize the Merchie, was when they ran into serious opposition. They were engaged in a picketing activity for about 80 days in the winter and spring of 1938, and eventually in April of 38, they were quite literally driven out of the county by vigilantes. Men who had worked at the Merchie or were continuing to work at the Merchie, and other people from other mines as well joined in and drove them off and somewhat systematically drove them out of the county. There was fortunately rather little bloodshed. No shot was ever fired in anger, so it wasn't the kind of bloodletting that you say had at the San Francisco waterfront strike of 1934. But it was a very serious action, and these men suffered for what they tried to do.
The real prosperity only lasted a few more years and really didn't. Would you say that World War II, the coming of the war, was what killed it?
The prosperity lasted into 1942, it seems to me that 41 was the high water mark as far as gold production and employment. But as soon as defense plants in the Bay Area started paying higher wages than mines, you had a trickle of men going down to the shipyards and to military installations, men going over to help build Camp Beale, and they were getting much higher wages than were available at the gold mines. And so what soon happened, and especially once America got into the war, was that the mines couldn't find the labor that they needed to keep working. And so that was really the beginning of the end. And then in October of 1942, by federal order, the gold mines were closed as a non-essential war industry. And that was pretty much the end for gold mining. mines did open, especially the Empire and the Idaho, Maryland, after the war, and continued into the mid-50s. But sort of the golden years were over when World War II began.
That was Gage McKinney, author of The 1930s, No Depression Here. He's going to be speaking at 7 p.m. on Friday, the 6th of November, at the Madeline Helling Library in Nevada City. He's also going to be speaking about the Grass Valley Cornish Carol Choir at the Grass Valley Newcomers Club at the Alta Sierra Country Club. That'll be at 12:45 p.m. on Wednesday, the 2nd of December. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'm gone. Jimmy Accardi is about to start his rock and roll party.